Chapter 8, Coming Up with the Game Plan. The heart of the great game of business is the annual game plan. By that I mean a set of financial statements spelling out what you expect to do month by month for the entire year. Without a plan, people have nothing to which they can compare their performance, no means of recognizing problems, no targets they can use to organize, motivate, and challenge themselves. They won't know what they have to do to support one another, or whether they are doing a good job, or how to evaluate the numbers they're generating on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. Emotions will cloud the picture. Barriers will go up. As a leader, you won't know whether to celebrate or sound the alarm. No matter what you do, people will second-guess you. As for the bonus program, don't waste your time on it. Without an annual plan, how could you ever come up with objective, quantifiable goals to shoot for? For that matter, how would you ever know if you reached them? The annual game plan will tell you that and keep you posted on the important matters. Is the company ahead of schedule, behind schedule, right on the money? Who's carrying the load? Who's falling behind? But just as important as the plan itself is the way you produce it. You need a plan that is firmly rooted in reality. You also need one that people not only accept but agree to without reservation. All the players must be ready to make the plan work. They have to want it to work. They must be willing to do whatever it takes to win. They must know they can count on everybody else to do the same, and that everybody else is counting on them. You can only get that sort of consensus by opening up the planning process and bringing the entire workforce in. Set it up so people know they own the process, know they are responsible for what comes out of it. That's the game. Otherwise, the plan will be a club, not a tool they can use in their work. And they'll regard the goals as yours, not theirs, which defeats the purpose of having them. It's very hard to get anyone motivated to achieve somebody else's goals. Remember that fifth higher law. You gotta wanna. So how can that happen? How do you set up an orderly planning process that becomes part of the game rather than the ordeal, that encourages everybody to participate, that makes sure each person is consulted about the decisions affecting his or her job, and that produces consensus on the final results? How do you do all that without bringing the company to a total standstill? How do you engage people into thinking about next year's plans and goals without distracting them from accomplishing what needs to be done here and now? Most important, how do you make it fun? Show people their stake in the process. When you put together your annual plan, you are designing the game you'll be playing for the next 12 months. This is everybody's big chance to say exactly how he or she thinks it ought to be set up. The whole idea is to come up with a game that people will play with a lot of enthusiasm, that they will care about winning. First, decide what winning means. Ask people. What do you think you can accomplish in the coming year? How much can you increase sales and production? Do you want to? What concerns do you have about the company? Are there problems that should be fixed? Do you want more space, new tools, additional perks or benefits? The planning process is a time to think about the future, to dream a little. It's also a time to think about what dangers may lie ahead so that you can figure out how to minimize them. And it's a time for everybody to say what they're willing to contribute, what commitments they will make to achieve goals you all agree upon. At the end of the process, you want to be able to tell people, here's what we say we want, and here's how we can get it, provided we all just do what we say we can do. The front line has to block, the running backs have to hustle, the punt return unit has to get good field position, the team has to play in true team spirit. There should be nothing boring about coming up with an annual game plan. Don't make the mistake of approaching it as an impossible but necessary ordeal. If it is, you've failed. The plan is the life of the company for the next year. If people are bored by the process of creating it, the way most people are bored by most planning processes, then there's little hope that they'll get excited about carrying it out, or that they'll even be able to. They won't take responsibility for it. They won't make the necessary commitments. That doesn't mean you have to invent a whole new way of planning. We use a process you can find in any textbook on budgeting. There are four phases based more on logic than anything else. Determine what your sales are likely to be in the coming year. Figure out what it's going to cost to produce these sales and how much cash you can expect to generate as a result. Decide what you want to do with that cash. Choose your bonus goals for the year. Simple stuff. What makes it all interesting, even exciting, is the drama that comes from having everyone involved. When we start out, we literally have no idea where we're going to wind up. It's not as if the top managers have already decided the basic shape of the plan. I am as much in the dark as the guy who picks parts in the warehouse, and both of us are curious about what lies ahead. Countdown to a new year. Step one in planning, put together a schedule. Without a schedule, there's a natural tendency to underestimate the time required, and you will probably let things slide. This year's demands always seem more pressing than next year's. As a result, you may wind up skipping important steps or be forced to rush to get things done. Either way, no one's going to have much fun and you won't produce a good plan. So how do you develop a planning schedule? Work backward from the new year. Figure out what you have to have when you finish and how long it will take to produce it. Our annual game plan has 8 documents: income statement, balance sheet, cash flow statement, sales and marketing plan, capital plan, inventory plan, organizational chart, and a compensation plan. You can undoubtedly get by with fewer. We did for years. The essential documents are the income statement, balance sheet, sales and marketing plan, and the compensation plan, which includes the specifics of our Stop Gooder bonus program for the year. The cash flow, capital, and inventory plans are tools that help us control the cash we generate. You too should have such tools, although you may not need so many. If your business doesn't have inventory, for example, you obviously don't need an inventory plan. We give ourselves more than 6 months to produce the plan. We could probably do it faster, but we like to take our time and make sure everybody has a chance to contribute. The first 2 months are relatively low-key, a period of preparation. Mainly, we're thinking about the sales forecast. Given its importance, we want to come up with one in which we have a great deal of confidence. The real excitement begins in October when we present the sales plan to the entire company, and from then on, the pace does not let up until the end of our fiscal year, January 31st, New Year's Eve at SRC. All planning begins with a sales forecast. There's a reason why the sales figure is at the top of the income statement. Without a sales line, you don't have an income statement. You can't feed anybody. There's no payroll to meet. The game is over before it begins. Everything in business begins with sales, including the planning process. I often run into CEOs who say, "I know we need a plan, but I don't know where to start." I tell them, bring your entire staff together, and in front of everybody else, ask the salespeople what they're going to sell for the month. The response is always the same. You know what they're going to tell me? They're going to say, "What number do you want to hear?" There lies the root of the problem. You will never get your salespeople to forecast accurately if you think they are doing it for your sake. It's not for your sake, or at least it shouldn't be. Without a forecast, the entire company suffers, which is why the rest of the staff should be in the room. Let other people tell sales how frustrating it is to work in a situation where you never know what you're going to be called on to do. It takes planning to live up to commitments, to support other people, to set and achieve goals. Nobody can plan without a forecast, and you can't have a game without a plan. The salespeople have to start the process. As soon as they say how much and what kind of business they're going to bring in, everybody else can begin to figure out what it will take to fill those orders, and you can lay the groundwork for the game. Yes, the forecast is a commitment, a big one, and it takes some courage for the salespeople to make it. But without it, none of the other commitments are possible. Insist on sales forecasts and make sure they are stable forecasts. You'll never come up with a reliable plan if the forecast is constantly changing. Key point: if you don't stabilize a sales forecast, you can't control your company. If you control a forecast, you control the world. Month 6. Hold an early sales meeting. Toward the end of July, We reserve several rooms at a beautiful resort in the Ozarks and bring all the sales and marketing people together for a two-day meeting. Remember, this is supposed to be fun. Each of the salespeople make a presentation about his or her expectations for the next 18 months. The head of the department gives an overview, and then other people discuss how they're coming along on their individual goals, what they are planning to do in the rest of the current year, and how they see the following year shaping up. Every member of the sales team gets up and talks. Managers from other parts of the company are present. We listen to the sales presentations, and we play a game of what if. We do everything we can to poke holes in salespeople's strategies. We're not trying to be mean or argumentative. On the contrary, we want to help them make the strongest possible forecast because it will serve as the foundation of our entire plan. So it's in everybody's interest that we identify any problems, false assumptions, unrealistic expectations, or hidden risks. Like, what is it going to cost to deliver on these sales commitments? Do we have the capacity, the skills, the equipment, the money? Can we get the parts we need? How fast does this customer have to pay their bills? How vulnerable are we to competition in the marketplace? What if the interest rates rise? What if this deal doesn't pan out? How likely is it that the customer will increase the order? How likely will it be that he could cancel the order? Can we handle that? What's our fallback position? Those are the kind of questions you have to put to your salespeople. Ask the toughest ones you can think of, and ask early enough in the process so that there is time to come up with the new answers or devise new contingency plans. Your company may not have a sales force per se. For example, you may have a professional service firm. In that case, go through the same exercise with whomever is responsible for bringing in customers. If that happens to be you, get together a group of friends and colleagues and have them grill you about your expectations for the coming year. One way or another, you want to wind up with the best sales forecast possible, and that means doing whatever you can to tear it apart before you embrace it. Month 5. Put together the sales plan and work on the standard costs. After you discuss the preliminary sales forecast, you need some time to come up with a better, stronger, smarter version. We generally allow ourselves 2 or 3 months, which gives us a chance to do a thorough job without neglecting our current needs. During that period, the sales and marketing people digest everything they heard at the July meeting and figure out how they should modify the sales plan. They do research, revise strategies, raise or lower estimates, go over schedules with customers, rethink contingencies, whatever. Meanwhile, they continue to probe the market, looking for fresh clues of what the coming year has in store. Toward the end of September, they pull all the information together in a new, improved sales plan. By then, we also pin down a lot of our costs, almost all of them, except the ones that depend on the final sales plan. We had one person, Doug Rothert, whose entire job was to figure out what our standard costs should be. In the course of the year, he reviewed every single cost or expense in the company. He was an accountant who served as our head of production for a while, and he helped to set up our original standard cost system. Then he spent most of his time wandering around the company, talking to people about what they were doing, working with them to come up with better, more accurate standards. That's what I mean by getting your accountants into the game. He also kept an eye on the areas in which we had trouble meeting our standards or met them so easily we'd left something on the table. Either one could be a sign that the standards needed to be revised. By the end of September, we talked to almost everyone in the company and had a fairly clear idea of how we thought our standard costs should be modified in the coming year. Goals, on the other hand, have only been discussed informally at this point, although we do know what issues people are concerned about and what things they'd like to see happen. I personally meet with all employees at least once in the course of each year. In late spring, I hold a series of meetings around the company in which I talk with people in groups of 20 or 30 and try to get a sense of what's on their mind. Sometimes I'll ask them to give me lists of suggestions for improving the company. We conduct a lot of surveys as well. For example, asking people to rate the ESOP in comparison to various benefit programs. We can use the responses to guide us in developing a game plan that people will feel enthusiastic about. Then there's the feedback we regularly get through staff meetings, not to mention what we pick up at the numerous company events. So all this information is floating around, giving us food for thought as we draw closer to goal setting time. 4, present and debate the sales plan. In October, the process moves into higher gear as the sales department comes out with the revised forecast. There is an extended staff meeting during which the plan is presented to the managers and middle managers who are going to take it to the rest of the workforce. Everybody gets a 5-page document dealing what we think our sales will be in the next 15 months, the last quarter of the current year, and the entire following year. The forecast is very specific, showing exactly how much each product is scheduled to be shipped to each customer in each month. That's important. A vague forecast is useless. People can't respond to it, and you can't base plans on it. Spell out precisely what you expect to sell, how much, and when, and it's better to be wrong than to be vague. Once the sales plan has been presented, we encourage everyone to go at it, to rip it apart, to expose any weaknesses or inconsistencies. The debate happens in 2 stages. First, the middle managers take the plan back to the frontline supervisors, who go over it carefully, paying close attention to the implications for their specific areas. Can they handle the level of production in the plan? What's the significance of the changes from this year to next? Do they make sense? At the same time, we are converting the dollar figures into pieces. For example, the actual number of fuel injection nozzles we'll have to produce month by month to meet the plan. The supervisors can take those numbers to the people on the shop floor and get them involved in the debate. Do we have enough people to take care of this? Are we overstaffed? What would we need in the way of equipment? How is this going to affect quality? This step, converting dollars into things, is important. You can only get people to contribute by putting the forecast into a form they can readily understand and react to, a form that corresponds to what they do every day. Obviously, that form will vary from business to business and from job to job. In a chain of restaurants, a sales forecast has different implications for the cooks, the waiters, and the people who buy the ingredients. In an airline company, the pilots will want to know how many flights they will have to make, how long the flights will be, and how often they will leave. The customer service representatives should know how many calls they'll be expected to handle, the purchasers on how many meals they'll have to order, the people on the counters how many tickets they'll have to write, and so on. Spell it out for people. Show them exactly what they will have to do to fulfill the sales plan. Make it easy for them to participate in the debate. If they don't have a chance to contribute, they won't take responsibility for the plan, and you may make mistakes that could have been avoided. The company-wide discussion of the sales forecast should not be just a public relations exercise. Listen to what people say. We definitely want people to take a hard look at the numbers and to insist on changes if the forecast is unrealistic. Sometimes there are major changes. In the fall of 1990, for example, people raised very tough questions about the sales department's optimistic predictions for the coming year. Weren't we going to be hurt by a recession that was already causing problems for our customers? What made us immune? No one had a convincing response, so we knocked down the sales forecast by about 15%, much to our subsequent relief. The recession hit us hard in the third quarter of the next year. At the end of October, the middle managers get back together with the salespeople to report what they've heard from the front lines and to come up with a consensus on the forecast. By then, some people have already begun to speculate about goals, but the serious discussion has to wait until our accountants take the numbers from the sales forecast, plug in the appropriate standard cost figures, and come up with a detailed plan for the next year. 3. Agree on the costs of executing the sales plan and start to target wants and worries. November is when we settled on the standards for the coming year. The accounting department distributes an in-depth month-to-month analysis of what it will cost to produce and deliver the goods in the sales forecast. Again, there is a debate. Although it tends to be quite focused at this point, most standards do not have to be changed very much from one year to another. When a standard is modified, there should be a specific reason. In our case, we may have a new machinery that has increased productivity, or perhaps someone has come up with a way to save money on parts, or we have figured out a more efficient production process, or we're facing stiffer competition in a particular role and have to cut costs in order to protect jobs. Whatever the reason for the change, it has usually been analyzed and discussed by the time November rolls around. In any event, the person in charge of standards goes over each one with the individuals affected. The supervisors and middle managers literally have to sign off on the changes before the budget can be approved. I personally review every change greater than 10%. We want to make sure that the standards are fair, that they are attainable, and that they keep us competitive in the market. We also want to know that all the players accept the standards everyone else is going to be expecting for them to meet. That way, the motivation for achieving the standards comes from the inside. When you choose your own targets, you can't blame anyone else if you miss. Of course, some people may complain anyway, human nature being what it is. They may blame the accounting department for giving them standards they couldn't meet. At that point, you want to be able to remind them that they saw and improved all the standards in advance. There's another reason to get approval of the standards. In giving it, people are making specific commitments to one another for the next 12 months. They are agreeing to carry their weight by meeting the standards. Those commitments are the basis of the game. Without them, there is no game. Just a different form of manipulation and coercion. Commitments are vital. You have to achieve consensus on the plan. Of course, you're much more likely to achieve consensus if you laid the necessary groundwork. Since you are launching the general discussion of goals, you will soon be deciding how to spend the cash generated under the plan. Ask people about their worries and their wants. Are there things that need fixing? Should equipment be replaced? Do they want new offices or factory space? What do they see as the greatest threats to their job? Perhaps it's the possibility of recession. You may want to reduce your debt. Perhaps it's delivery to customers. You may want to increase finished goods inventory. Perhaps it's quality. You may want to introduce new processes. It doesn't matter where the dangers may lie, in the economy, in the marketplace, or the company itself. You want people to look over the entire landscape and talk about their most pressing concerns and urgent desires. After all, you have a limited amount of cash which to address those concerns and fulfill those desires. So it's important to find out which ones are most important to people. We do that by having a company-wide discussion that begins in November and continues intermittently for several weeks. We raise the issue in staff meetings, and the people there take it back to the rest of the organization. Pretty soon, we begin to get feedback. If there seems to be a broad consensus, we begin to draw up lists. If more discussion is needed, we hold additional meetings either at the company or off-site. In any case, we keep talking until there is a general agreement about how we should be spending our cash and what we should focus on fixing in the coming year. Month 2. Figure out what to do with the cash and zero in on the bonus goals. As soon as you have all the numbers for sales, production costs, and other expenses, you can put together an income statement for the coming year. Break it down month by month so you can see exactly what you expect to do and when you expect to do it. From the income statement, you can construct a preliminary balance sheet and cash flow plan, which you can then use to focus the discussion about cash. We generally do this in December. We draw up a set of pending financial statements and present them at one of the staff meetings. We say, look, if we execute this plan and meet our standards, we should be able to generate this much cash. What do you think we ought to do with it? The middle managers will take the information back to the rest of the company. At this point, you have to start making decisions. Use the balance sheet as your guide. It will show you the different places cash goes. For example, how much you want to put in the plant, property, and equipment. That's a particularly important question in a capital-intensive business like ours, but almost every business has to answer it. Can you get by with the equipment you have, or is now the time to replace it? Do you have enough space in your present facilities? Should you be buying that building across town? The answers to such questions will serve as the basis for your capital plan for the year, which should also be broken down month by month so you can see when you're spending the cash as well as how much and what for. Cash can also go into inventory, assuming there is such a thing in your business. If you're not careful, you may wind up with more cash in the form of inventory than you need. So you should also have an inventory plan. What additional parts and supplies do you need to produce at the rate required by the sales plan? When do you need them? How fast are we going to be shipping finished products? Again, break out the numbers by the month. Wherever cash can go, you need a plan. Understand that I'm speaking here of categories in the balance sheet, of assets and liabilities, not of expenses and costs that show up on the income statement. In your business, you may spend a lot of money, say, on entertaining customers, but you should also have taken those expenses into account in putting together your projected income statement. At this point in the planning process, you are really figuring out how you want your balance sheet to look at the end of the year. If the cash you've generated is tied up in buildings, equipment, and inventory, it won't be available for bonuses, dividends, buying back stock from people, paying off debt, whatever. That doesn't mean you shouldn't increase inventory and invest in buildings. Perhaps you think having more inventory would improve customer service, or expanding your facilities would do wonders for morale. By all means, do it. But how you spend your cash should be a conscious decision. The money shouldn't disappear just because no one is paying attention. And believe me, it will disappear. Not that people will steal it, although theft is a lot more likely if you don't have a plan. Rather, the cash will be spent on things you don't really want and don't really need. Decide in advance where you want the cash to go. Look at your business and identify where cash can be absorbed. There are only so many possibilities: inventory, equipment, furnishings, vehicles, whatever. Then come up with a plan based on your real needs in each area. Once again, make sure you get a lot of input from the individuals affected: warehouse people, engineers, men and women who are using machines, their supervisors and department managers. They are the ones who will have to live with the consequences of the decisions, so it's essential that they make them. Don't undermine the consensus you achieve on the overall game plan by forgetting to ask people whether or not they have the equipment they need to play. Keep your projected balance sheet and cash flow statement in front of you while you're figuring out what to do. In December and January, we continually play with both of these statements, calculating and recalculating the numbers to see what effect different plans will have on our ability to pay bonuses, put money into ESOP, or buy back stock. If cash looks tight, for example, we may hold off purchasing that new computer or building an addition on the factory. We may also consider choosing a bonus goal aimed at increasing our liquidity. In fact, there's a close relationship between our decisions on how to spend cash and what to target in the bonus program, since both must take into account the long-term health of the company. Before we make these decisions, we want to have a consensus about our wants and weaknesses. By the middle of December, that consensus is beginning to emerge. As we put together the capital plan and the inventory plan, we also come up with a list of possible bonus goals based on the feedback from the company. We may even start trying out formulas, plugging in various numbers to see their effect on the income statement and the balance sheet. But we wait until the very end of the process to make our final decisions on the goals. We want all the information out in front of us when we do. These targets will be our top priorities in the coming year. We will all be doing everything we can to hit them. When we choose them, we are saying, in effect, these are our critical numbers. We have to do well on them to have a good year. By January, we're ready to make the choice. Month 1, decide on the bonus program and submit the final plan. There are, as I noted in the last chapter, two types of goals in the bonus program: one from the income statement, one from the balance sheet. Since we put so much effort into achieving these goals, we want to be sure we are making ourselves stronger in the process. Consequently, we spend a lot of time thinking about our weaknesses before deciding what our goals will be. Our approach is based on the simple premise that every business has different strengths and weaknesses, which vary from year to year. The weaknesses are a threat to job security. People may go out and work hard, but because of these weaknesses, their jobs may be jeopardized by outside forces. So how can we minimize the danger? One way is to use the bonus program. Target your goals to shore up your weaknesses as a business. Of course, you're never going to eliminate weaknesses. You can't avoid making mistakes. Nor are you going to succeed at everything you do. We all have to be able to fail from time to time. That's the only way we learn. So it's important to give people the leeway to fail, the leeway to make mistakes, without jeopardizing job security. We do that first by identifying the factors that pose the biggest threats to job security. And then by selecting bonus goals, it keeps everyone's attention focused on wiping out those threats. In effect, we are promising to pay ourselves a reward for doing the things required to protect our jobs. We are putting a bounty on our weaknesses each year. We are saying, wanted, a $29 charge-out rate, or wanted, a 20% increase in the current ratio. And if we bring it in, we pay ourselves very well indeed. There's no reason other companies can't follow the same approach. The first step, obviously, is to identify the threats to your business. That's actually quite easy. Ask your people. They know. They will tell you. Get them to talk about the things that most concern them as they look around. What does the company do badly? Where is it vulnerable to competitors? What are the dangers they see in the economy? How might the company be at risk? I guarantee you they will come up with a comprehensive and revealing list of dangers. That's an important list to have in any event because it tells you the issues you should be paying attention to through the bonus program or otherwise. To turn a threat into a business goal, however, you have to go a step further and quantify it. You have to come up with an absolute measure that leaves no room for doubt as to whether or not a goal has been achieved. People must have total confidence in the results of the bonus game. They must know that the score is accurate, fair, and objective. It could not have been manipulated by anyone. That way, when they win, it is their victory, and when they come up short, they only have themselves to blame. You never want to be in a situation where you miss a target by a tiny amount, but it's really a judgment call. Then you're in a real bind. If you give out the bonus program anyway, it's a hell of a victory. If you don't, you create a lot of resentment. In either case, you undermine the bonus program as a motivator. This is the main reason we never made quality a bonus goal, although it always appears on our list of potential threats. We can't figure out how to measure quality so that the results wouldn't be subject to manipulation. As a result, we address the quality issue through other programs, and we use the bonus programs to go after things we can quantify using the financial statements. We chose the liquidity goal, for example, because people thought there was a recession coming. That was their major worry. So we wanted a goal that would make us strong enough to get through a serious downturn. The more liquid a company is, the more flexible it can be in a bad economic environment. And you can measure liquidity with the current ratio. That is, the ratio of short-term assets, including cash, to short-term liabilities. Improving the current ratio became one of the goals. In fact, the two goals tend to reinforce each other and thus may address similar concerns. At one point, for example, people were worried about an internal threat, our ability to keep track of the parts and supplies we had on hand. Inventory accuracy had fallen to 40%. In other words, our records show that we had the parts we needed, but when we went to get them, they often weren't there. Inventory is a financial asset and therefore a balance sheet item, but it has a big impact on production. If the part isn't there when you need it, production stops until you get it. That affects the income statement. Our standard cost guy told me we'd see great increases in productivity if we could achieve an accuracy level of 95%. Sure enough, when the accuracy rose, the profits rose. It was unbelievable. We got a tremendous boost in overhead absorption and a big drop in the charge-out rate, which helped us to meet the income statement goal as well. In many cases, of course, the real challenge is to figure out how to quantify a target that everybody agrees is worth going after. The process is the same as the one described in Chapter 6 when I discussed the art of quantifying as it applied to developing standards and benchmarks. That's exactly what you're doing here. Once you know what people are concerned about and what they want, you look for the benchmark for which they can aim. By putting these benchmarks into the bonus program, you are creating a powerful tool for educating people. You can use the excitement of the bonus game to show people how, by reaching these financial benchmarks, they can attain their personal goals. And not just their short-term goals either. How they can attain their long-term goals as well as their dreams. But to do this, you must completely throw open the goal-setting process and let people choose their own goals. Then you can spend the rest of the year talking to people about not letting themselves down. You don't have to ask them to do this or that for the company. You can get them focusing beyond the company on something that is more important to them than the company, namely their own lives. They're protecting their jobs. They're achieving their dreams. They're not doing it for you. They're doing it for themselves. If they leave money lying on the table, they are the big losers. Your role is to help them succeed. For us, the selection of the Stop Gooter goals is the culmination of the entire process of developing an annual game plan. Everything else we do is geared toward putting the pieces in place so that we can say, these are the biggest concerns we have and the things we want the most, and here's how we're going to go after them. This is a month-by-month plan we can follow over the next year to attack the threats to our job security and, at the same time, take care of some of our wishes. The final step is to submit the plan to the board of directors. They do another round of what-ifs. What are the contingency plans? What are the trap doors? What if this doesn't work? What if this doesn't happen? We go over the checks and balances. We re-examine our internal controls. We make sure we have everything set up to run the right way. Then we launch the plan. We come back in the last week of the fiscal year and say, okay, here's the new game. The eighth higher law is, when people set their own targets, they usually hit them. An invitation to skeptics. I know some people will say, these targets sound very nice and orderly, but business just isn't that predictable. You must constantly be running into unexpected opportunities and problems. What if a customer shows up in May and throws all your plans out of whack? What if you suddenly find yourself with tough, new competition, and you have to revamp your entire cost structure? You can't have a plan that is good for an entire year. It's just not possible in this day and age. I'd like to invite all of you skeptics to attend one of the monthly seminars and sit in on a staff meeting. Call us at 800-386-2752. We'll set it up. You can watch as we go down the income statement line by line. You'll hear person after person reporting numbers that are off by the projection of less than $100. Monthly sales vary less than 5%, even in a volatile year. Frankly, it's unreal how close people come to the projections. But even if something happens to throw the projections off, never change the annual game plan in the middle of the year. If the plan is a disaster, as our first one was, cancel it. Otherwise, stay with it. Changing the plan is like changing location of the holes in the middle of a golf tournament. To be sure, you can't anticipate everything. There will be unexpected developments. For example, one year we brought in a new business in the middle of the year. We hadn't expected it, and it cost us money to take it on, and we didn't reap the benefits until later. That was the year we didn't earn any bonuses. The new business was a factor, but not a major one. We went over the sales projections by about $4 million, which meant we could have had another $200,000 in pre-tax profits to get into the first payout level. We missed it by about $700,000. So it goes. You never change the plan, regardless of the surprises that come along. Stick with it no matter what. That happens in January, the final month of our fiscal year. By then, everyone in the company has had a chance to talk about the various goals under consideration, and we reach a consensus about two or three of the goals. We also played with the numbers enough to figure out the appropriate levels and payouts, as described in Chapter 7. So we put together the compensation program, which is the last section of the game plan. The various sections go into a big, black, three-ring notebook, affectionately known as the Bible. We present copies of the new Bible at the staff meeting. We say, do you like it? Is there anything you want to change? Occasionally there is, although we try to do the most of our arguing early in the process. We prefer not to make big changes so close to the wire.